There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Uh-huh.
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical look at our media environment. My name is Paul Riismandel. I'm your host. Producer Drew Tirico is at the controls. On today's program, intellectual property, media ownership, indecency challenges, and more. That's right, we wrap up some news of our media environment and get you up to date. Do stay tuned. Here on Media Geek, we try to bring you news of our media environment that often gets shunted to the back pages of the business section in our newspapers and often doesn't get reported at all in the electronic media, because we think that news about media regulation, ownership, and the corporations behind it all is important to democracy and not just business. On February 22nd, a federal appeals court sharply questioned whether the Federal Communications Commission has the authority to force electronics makers to implement digital rights management controls in devices that can receive digital TV signals. This rule requiring the so-called broadcast flag is intended to go into effect this July. 2 to 3 judges on the District of Columbia Circuit Court said the FCC never received permission from Congress to undertake such a sweeping regulation. The broadcast flag was encouraged by the entertainment industry and broadcasters and is intended to encourage the purchase of digital TV receivers that curb internet distribution of digital television broadcasts. Judge Harry Edwards questioned FCC lawyers, asking, quote, "You're out there in the whole world regulating. Are washing machines next?" End quote. Judge David Sentell remarked, quote, "You can't regulate washing machines. You can't rule the world." End quote. If implemented, the broadcast flag rule requires every product that can receive digital TV signals, including televisions, VCRs, and computer peripherals, to be able to lock out copying and other uses of program content based upon instructions from broadcasters that are embedded in the digital TV signal. The groups challenging the FCC's broadcast flag regulation include the American Library Association, the Association of Research Libraries, the Medical Library Association, Public Knowledge, and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They argue that the FCC exceeded its authority, that Congress should be responsible for making copyright law, and that librarians' ability to make fair use of digital broadcasts will be unreasonably curtailed.
And industry copyright enthusiasts, such as the RIAA and MPAA, have once again mounted a large legal campaign, and this has been mounting for the past few months, against a file-sharing technology, and this time, it's the peer-to-peer client Grokster. The Supreme Court has accepted the case of MGM versus Grokster, and will hear arguments in March on whether to pull the plug on it or not. This could seal the fate of peer-to-peer technology to being federally prohibited, a new encroachment of federalism on internet technology. Listeners are probably familiar with the fate of Napster, a similar piece of software. In the case of A&M Records versus Napster, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that Napster must cease and desist operations because of its use as an aid to illegal sharing of copyrighted material. Thus, any piece of software that uses Napster-style sharing is illegal. What has saved other sharing utilities like BitTorrent, Kazaa, eMule, BearShare, and now Grokster is that the list of shared files is stored on the network and not on a central server as in the case of Napster. Decentralized networks are a foundation of the way the internet works. Aside from a few ground rules in place to help computers find each other, the internet at its core is an almost completely open communication system. Once part of the network, any computer can connect to any other and access whatever each administrator chooses to share. Technologies like peer-to-peer clients simply make it easier for users to seek out and obtain specific types of data, in this case music, video, and other software. A federal mandate of banning this technology could have profound effects on the scope of future internet regulations, especially as it relates to how media are transferred.
What's interesting in this case is, well, the operative case mm-hmm. that we're relying upon, the Supreme Court ruling is the Sony decision, so-called, which pitted the Motion Picture Association of America against Sony over the Betamax.
Uh-huh.
Which was the VCR, right? And Betamax was the leading VCR at the time in the early 1980s. And this was before Sony itself got into the motion picture industry. And the movie industry sued Sony, saying that your device, the VCR, is specifically there to allow people to copy and pirate movies. It's specifically there allowed them to copy and pirate TV programs, and is fundamentally an infringing technology. And what's very important, of course, in that Supreme Court case is that the court found that this is not true, that although mm-hmm. the technology may be used for infringing purposes, that is not the fundamental purpose of that device. And that is indeed the ruling which the appeals court pulled upon for the Grokster case, saying that mm-hmm. you could share many things on Grokster. And unlike Napster, which only allowed you to share MP3 files, Grokster right. allows you to share, as I understand, just about everything.
Yeah, it's like similar to BitTorrent in that respect.
Or because I think it's based on basically the same technology as Kazaa yeah. and allows you to share anything. So while you can share movies, you could share music, you can also share pictures, you could share documents. And I know mm-hmm. that many people have released documents that can be considered underground, things
exactly.
that would be considered illegal in some more repressive regimes, and gotten them available to people in places like Iran or China through these peer-to-peer networks, where they would not be accessible by web servers because these different nations actually filter what
really?
Part of the World Wide mm-hmm. Web that users within those nations can see. So there are many other uses, but of course, one of the uses that it can do is for sharing MP3 files
mm-hmm.
and sharing movie files. And the RIAA is Recording Industry Association of America, and the MPAA is the Motion Picture Association of America. Of course, this has been a long-standing fight, so it'll be very interesting to see where the Supreme Court goes on this, because, I think the larger argument that people see is, you know, how much are we going to regulate the ability of people to move content around on the internet? And two, of course, is a question is, how effective could any such regulation be?
Yeah.
The shutdown of Grokster, okay, will that stem the tide, or will it simply push it underground?
Mm-hmm.
You know, software piracy is officially illegal.
And of
right?
course, it's a
huge... And of course, it's rampant. You know, it doesn't seem to really necessarily stem the tide, although I would argue that the broadcast, the Business Software Alliance, BSA, has probably forced most business users to buy their software, especially mm-hmm. places like universities and large corporations, where they have a lot more pull, but may have not been quite so effective on the bedroom computers of 13-year-olds.
Which is why, yes, it's much harder to obtain this sort of commercial software than it is to get sort of the end-user software that you can on most pirating sites. And it's a similar case with, it's harder to find some, hard-to-find documentaries where the producers are putting out, low volumes of these things. It's much easier to find, the latest Usher album, say, on Grokster or Napster, than it is to find sort of these, these starving artists. So this is the argument that's used, is that starving artists are suffering because of this software. No one's buying their records, and we can't give them any money for food now, these poor starving artists. And you found a list of artists that were against this, and there was
who are supporting the RIAA mm-hmm. and the MPAA, including like the Dixie Chicks, the Eagles,
mm-hmm.
the Bare Naked Ladies.
Yeah,
they seem to be suffering a lot. Avril
yeah.
Lavigne, another suffering artist. She seems to be having difficulty putting even food on her plate. Apparently, looking at her because of the evil Grokster depriving
due to
her
peer-to-peer sharing, of course,
of her funds. And I guess there's some folks who break it down as a more philosophical argument, and that stealing is stealing,
mm-hmm.
right? And therefore, if it's stealing, it must be illegal. But of course, there are lots of things which allow you to steal that are not illegal, including cars.
Yes,
are not illegal. They certainly can aid you in all sorts of theft, as
guns. Guns are legal.
Yeah, that guns, I think, aid in most armed robberies.
I think they do.
And guns have not yet been made illegal due to their use in, and really the way they help you do such things. Mm-hmm. And naturally, the argument that's at hand when it comes to peer-to-peer technologies is you know, what is its fundamental use, and is it possible to use it for non-infringing purposes? The interesting thing about Grokster and these other things is that these are companies. These are, you know, there is someone there to sue who are ostensibly profiting from the software. And I know that many of the peer-to-peer software makers are not necessarily always the most upstanding individuals themselves, since I know Kazaa specifically installs all sorts of spyware and other sorts of extra unwanted software on your system when you install Kazaa, because they don't really make any money when you're downloading things. They only make money because they can sell your computer time to people who want to throw adware and spyware on your machine. And yeah, so, you know, it's kind of a slimy business all around.
It's really slimy.
All around. No one seems to come out very clean, which is to be opposed to things that have come from more of the open source community, like BitTorrent, which is freely, you know, written and accessible and is not a for-profit company. And, of course, is even somewhat more, I would say, clever in its execution, because it allows you to download files from multiple computers simultaneously. And also, unlike a Grokster, doesn't create any sort of central database. Although many of the sites that try to provide central databases of torrent files, as they're called, have been shut down.
I see.
By the MPAA in recent months, though we haven't had much of a chance to cover that. But it's going to be an interesting case. But going to the Supreme Court means that it has the opportunity to become the law of the land. Mm-hmm. And this can happen even if the Supreme Court decides not to rule in a very cleanly one way or the other, but there can be nuance in the ruling which will dictate, you know, to what extent a peer-to-peer technology can be legal, at least in the United States.
Sure.
And to the extent to which, you know, the United States controls the internet.
Well, oddly enough, I mean, Grokster is based in the they're based in the West Indies, they said.
Right. Right, like many a financial corporation.
Yeah.
to avoid much of Western Europe and the United States financial securities laws and taxes.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be based in these, you know, small countries that have very lax laws that intended to, you know, sort of business havens. So let's move on to our next set of stories here. 60 national, state, and local organizations led by the media reform groups Free Press and the Media Access Project released an open letter on February 22nd in support of allowing municipalities and other public entities to deploy broadband internet systems. The letter was made public at a Senate briefing. The letter opposes the campaign by incumbent television and cable providers to push legislation through numerous state legislatures that would either ban or make it more difficult for municipalities to deploy broadband systems. As reported on last week's edition of Media Geek, Illinois is one of the states where the legislature is considering a bill to keep the state and its municipalities from offering any sort of telecommunications service, including wired or wireless broadband internet. Local governments, municipal utilities, and community media outlets from 19 states and the District of Columbia also endorsed the letter. In addition, the letter is signed by a number of the nation's most innovative community networking projects, such as the Austin Wireless City Project, the Champaign-Urbana Community Wireless Network, Chicago Center for Neighborhood Technology, and New York City Wireless.
And this, again, promises to be a fight of grassroots activists against another large lobbying group. This is the telecom industry that's basically circulated this legislation among many state legislatures.
And it's pretty much the same legislation.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, they hand it over to an industry-friendly representative in each state.
Mm-hmm.
But word for word, it's pretty much the same legislation. It's cookie cutter, and they're just passing it on to their cronies in the state legislatures.
We'll see how it shapes up. Senator John McCain has introduced a bill into Congress that he hopes would close some loopholes in television ownership regulation. McCain's bill takes aim at the renewal of local TV licenses and the dual ownership of newspapers and TV stations in the same market. At a February 15th press conference, McCain cited a recent study by the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communications, which found that local TV news spent more time on sports and weather than on local political races during the 2004 campaign season. McCain connected this poor performance to concentrated non-local ownership. He told the press, quote, There's no doubt that locally owned television stations produce more local news. Media consolidation plays into this, end quote. If passed, McCain's bill would require TV stations to renew their licenses every 3 years instead of the current 8. The bill would also require the FCC to review the performance of all companies' stations, not just the one up for renewal. Broadcast station owners such as Tribune Company have relied on the long renewal term to buy newspapers in markets where they own TV stations, an apparent violation of FCC rules. These media companies are not at risk of violating the cross-ownership provision until their license is up for examination, and so they're able to violate cross-ownership rules for up to 7 years before suffering FCC action. McCain's bill is called the Localism in Broadcasting Reform Act of 2005, and he hopes the Senate Commerce Committee will hold hearings on it this spring.
And recent changes to radio ownership rules may threaten a popular Clear Channel station in Los Angeles. The station is called Indy 103.1, which garnered Rolling Stone magazine's honor as America's coolest commercial station for eschewing the typical tightly playlisted rock radio format in favor of a looser approach, more typical of college and the freeform radio of years past. Indy 103.1 is owned by Entravision Communications Corporation, a Santa Monica-based Spanish-language media company, but it went on the air 14 months ago under a so-called joint sales agreement with Clear Channel, the largest radio station operator in the U.S. and the owner of 8 stations in the L.A. market. Revised Federal Communications Commission regulations redefine joint sales agreements in such a way that Indy 103.1 constitutes Clear Channel's 9th station in the L.A. area, and federal media rules bar any company from owning more than 8. Clear Channel's regional vice president in Los Angeles said the company would walk away from the partnership on April 1. It's unclear whether Entravision will continue the format without the business benefits of the arrangement with Clear Channel, which used its clout to line up advertisers for the station. Clear Channel used many of the market-dominating techniques it innovated to bolster the station's ad revenue. Clear Channel's advertising staff sold time on Indy 103.1 at rates lower than those offered by the region's dominant rock station and also bundled ads with its other area stations.
Yeah, this is an interesting case because Clear Channel's sort of been selling ads on this station, which is very much sort of this indie-centric station. It's actually about to go digital soon, too. This is part of this whole divide and conquer, you know, of make these indie stations very small digital bands, and you can squeeze a bunch of them in, and then perhaps Clear Channel, you know, can just basically sell ads on all of them without owning any of them, too.
Well, what's interesting, one, is that the name Indy has gone from being descriptive and meaningful as an independent
right.
to being now a marketing brand.
Exactly.
So is Indy is now a category.
Which just basically means that these songs are not on a major top 40 playlist.
Right, they're not the major playlist. Well, Clear Channel's actually been struggling. Their stock prices have been dipping because overall radio listenership has been going down. And most people attribute, you know, this decline in commercial radio listening to the fact that radio became, in the last 10 years, so playlisted, so road, and also so non-local. Recently, Clear Channel announced that it was reducing the number of ads in a given hour on its stations because they were noticing declining listenership. And one of the biggest complaints listeners had was being bombarded with so many ads, so many in a row, so often while they're listening. And so, you know, this Indy 103.1, you know, it's not really revolutionary, and it's really not different. What it is it's a dominant radio player going for another niche.
Mm-hmm.
It's really more akin to what happens on cable, or what has happened on cable, than anything else. When you're a dominant player in some particular market like cable television or on radio, you know, you use a divide and conquer technique. You try and target every little market niche you can with their own little sliver of programming and hoping to do some saturation for them all. Mm-hmm. In a large market like Los Angeles, which I believe is the second largest radio market in the country, I mean, that's a huge area. And even when you go for a small market niche like independent rock or shall we say more underground or alternative rock, that's still a fairly large segment of the population, and as they found out, in at least in the Los Angeles area, a fairly affluent segment of the population that has higher than average incomes and also higher than average disposable income. Mm-hmm. So very, very valuable to advertisers. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, to an extent, you look at that and you try and tailor your radio station to meet that. And it is one station out of a, at this point, 9 station Los Angeles empire. It's a relatively small gamble all around. You know, it's one station out of 1,200.
Right.
This is not as if Clear Channel had decided even to dedicate 1/12 of its resources to do 100 stations nationwide with this. It's interesting that they also do with a station they don't own. It's easier mm-hmm. to experiment with a station you don't own and bundle in the ads so that it becomes really just a very small portion of your overall revenue in that market. It's actually very shrewd from a marketing standpoint. It's also very shrewd from an overall programming standpoint, which Clear Channel's always been. So it's overall not as surprising, you know, that they're taking that tact. And of course, as you might see with something like MTV, mm-hmm. Something that starts out as somewhat innovative and maybe very niche marketed often ends up as being much more broad and, again, often abandoning the very thing it attests to being. MTV now mm-hmm. more of a lifestyle channel for young people than having anything necessarily to do with music on any regular basis. We don't know how long Indie 103.1 would stay the way it is. So for all those people in LA crying, I wish to tell them that you're going to be crying sooner or later. But what's interesting is the FCC going after this joint marketing agreement is really a way of bolstering the existing ownership rules, because they've seen, you know, the ownership rules, you know, as put down in 1996, which for radio were horribly loosened, nevertheless get even loosened more as loopholes were found and, you know, more holes were punched in the bucket by the likes of Clear Channel. And as mm-hmm. you know, as you noted in John McCain's case, when he's noting that because of the long licensing renewal time between TV stations, the FCC really can't keep tabs on everybody. So you can basically violate the rules for several years and reap the profits of violating those rules, and then only at license renewal time come up and say, oh, okay, I guess we'll divest ourselves of this station.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In this case, Clear Channel is not going to reap any real penalties for owning 9 stations or effectively running 9 stations. They're simply going to divest themselves of this little experiment, and it'll go the way it goes. And of course, they'll love it, because then they'll be able to say in the LA press, well, you lost this great innovative station because of pernicious regulation. You know, when indeed they could take any of the other 8 stations they have and turn it into the Indie 103.1 or whatever format it wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Clear Channel, I mean, they're definitely, although they have a reputation for being very politically conservative, by and large, they are about profits.
Definitely.
And one of the reasons that America is doing well is because of Clear Channel. Because mm-hmm. in many markets where they have already have a conservative talk station, they've been toying with liberal talk. Because divide and conquer. Mm-hmm. We might, you know, if there's an audience for liberal talk, we might as well capture that rather than losing it entirely, since we already have the conservative talk market ostensibly locked up. And it's all about, you know, profit setting, to the exactly. extent to which that'll make them any money. They'll do it. And of course, when you own 8 stations, the whole point is, you know, you don't expect all of them to be number 1 or number 1 through 8, but you expect that all together that they beat out all your competitors. And, you know, and you do that by doing the same way Walmart sells CDs, as you do it through loss leaders. So you take some stations at the bottom, you know, the least popular, the least well-rated, and you sell that advertising at rates that other owners, other blocks just simply mm-hmm. cannot meet. So you basically run your competitors out of the market, or you run them, you know, down in their profits if you can't actually beat them in the ratings. So, mm-hmm. you know, this is all part and parcel, and it's nice to see, you know, a couple of these little holes being plugged up, even if it won't cause Clear Channel to divest themselves of the other 8 stations they own.
Do you think maybe Clear Channel is just trying to move more in the direction of strictly being an advertising company? I mean, they've been, they're a major player in the Billboard market.
I think that's especially. What they are. I mean, I think if you really get into it, radio is an advertising business.
Absolutely.
Right? It really is nothing to, when it comes to at least commercial radio, it has nothing to do with the content. Mm-hmm. The content is there simply to sell ear time to advertisers.
Exactly.
So, yeah, indeed, radio is just sonic billboards. I think you're exactly correct. Billboards are hard to avoid if you have eyes in the landscape. Radio, you don't have to turn it on, so they have to give you a reason to attract you to tune in. But essentially, yes, it's sonic billboards. And that's really what Clear Channel is becoming, both in their concert promotions and billboards and in radio. Cross promotion like crazy. And of course, yeah, It's all about the advertising. Whatever will sell, will sell.
They've been getting burned on the content repeatedly. I mean, in the press, and there's no one that's going to sing the praises of Clear Channel's content. Not even the broadcasting industry.
That's why they want to do Indie 103.1, exactly. Because all that positive press is worth a lot when you've been getting lots of negative press. But, you know, there's a lot more negative press to be had because they have a lot of joint sales agreements.
Yes, they do.
There may be many more comeuppances for Clear Channel across the country.
According to a story published in the Los Angeles Times this week, broadcasters are expected to bring suit against the FCC later this spring in an effort to force the agency to clarify indecency rules. The push to bring new legal challenge comes as Congress is seeking to boost indecency penalties at least tenfold to as much as $500,000 an incident. It also coincides with a pending change in leadership at the FCC, where Republican Kevin Martin, considered tough on indecency, is the leading candidate to replace Chairman Michael K. Powell, who is stepping down. Broadcasters haven't brought a major indecency case since 1978, when the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the FCC's authority to issue indecency fines. That case centered on Pacifica's radio station WBAI in New York, airing in 1973 of comedian George Carlin's Seven Words You Can Never Say on Television routine. The High Court's ruling also established what is known as the Free Harbor period of 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., wherein broadcasters are permitted to air indecent programming. The court's logic in upholding the FCC's ability to enforce indecency rules was that it was in the public interest to reduce the likelihood of children accidentally being exposed to this terrible indecent material. However, the court established the Free Harbor because it believed an outright ban on indecency was unconstitutional.
And in that court opinion is if we make programming, all radio programming, only suitable for children, then we really only allow programming suited for children.
Exactly. So we've become
or childish programming.
You know, some people would argue we become a nation of children because of this. Because of this,
it's been a very interesting political bugaboo, and I do think, like all of these things, it will die down. It's interesting that the broadcasters are bringing their challenge because indecency rules are arcane and difficult to figure out. Only after much hemming and hawing and much force by Congress and the courts, the FCC released a position paper a few years ago outlining what it considered indecent and not indecent. And it is a large, thick document that tried to use, that relied upon past rulings to say what is indecent and what is not. And actually did say that simply saying the F word did not make something indecent. And the one case they used as an example is when NPR aired these tapes of New York mobsters that the FBI had that were uncensored. And so this is the mobsters in their own F-word glory on NPR when they gave a warning saying that these words were on. And the FCC said this is not indecent. This was, you know, this was in sort of news verite, you know, indicative of what you would hear. And it was not simply there to titillate, but was there to actually inform, to bring people what it believes was actual news. But the FCC, I think, has been retreating from that ever since the Janet Jackson incident. And certainly their decision to, you know, to go after NBC over Bono using the F word during the Golden Globes, after they initially said they wouldn't, is the largest indicator that they're really receding from the line they set even just a few years ago and taking a much more, shall we say, unnuanced and knee-jerk approach to indecency, such that, you know, individual words, context be damned, are indecent but in their very utterance, rather than what is the actual intent and what is the actual content.
As in the case of Bono uttering...
this is just effing great or whatever, effing incredible. Well, I think that brings us to the end of the news this week. We're working on a story for next week regarding what looks like some interesting goings-on in the world of Christian non-commercial radio and the trading and profiting from licenses for translator low power stations. So we hope to have some interesting juicy stuff for you next week. You'll definitely want to stay tuned, and also tune into the Media Geek blog at www.mediageek.org, where we're also getting part of the story published as it develops. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek on the web at www.mediageek.org. There you can read the Media Geek blog for news that can't fit onto the show, as well as download archive episodes of the program in MP3 in the open-source Ogg Vorbis format. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to paul@mediageek.org. I'm host and executive producer Paul Riesmandel. Our producer is Drew Tirico. Media Geek is produced live at community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek is also heard on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and on KQRP in Salida, California. And Media Geek is free to broadcast on your local non-commercial station, too. To inquire, please send email to paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.